Hi, I'm Logan Medish, host of the High Caliber History Podcast, and on today's episode, we're going to be talking about a new museum that'll be opening up and its role of firearms in the exhibits, as well as a gun designer from the past that their curator wants to meet so that he can punch him in the face. All of that and more on this episode. Make sure you stay tuned. It's going to be a good one. Hi, everyone. I'm Logan Medish, the host of the High Caliber History Podcast, and my guest today is Dave Kennedy. He is the curator of collections and exhibits at the United States Marshals Museum in Fort Smith, Arkansas. His responsibilities there include care of the collection objects, historical research, and integration of the collection into the exhibits. He's worked in similar positions with the Oklahoma Historical Society and at the Cody Firearms Museum, which is part of the Buffalo Bill Center of the West. Dave has spent most of his life studying and working with the history of the American West and firearms in a museum environment, and he's got both a BA and an MA in history, so Dave knows his stuff. And above all, he believes that museums are a great educational equalizer and that the strength of museums lies in the collections they hold and protect. Dave, I love that last sentence. That is a fantastic sentence. Welcome to the High Caliber History Podcast. It's good to talk to you, my friend.
Nice to talk to you. Thanks for having me on here, Logan. This is always fun to talk to friends.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, the museums being the great educational equalizer. I mean, that's important whether we're talking a science museum or an art museum or a history museum, but particularly with the goal of this podcast and partially with what you're doing at the Marshals Museum, particularly when we're talking about firearms. It's certainly, it's all about education there because things can certainly go off the rails if we're not careful to educate, right?
Yeah, it's part of that whole argument for me is that most of, everybody, obviously, we all go to school. But with that formal education, there's only so much that gets talked about. And it's often one of the complaints people have, whether it's about history or if it's about science or if it's about just whatever the subject is in school. People complain, well, that's not the whatever they taught me when I was a kid. And it's like, well, it's because our understanding of different things increases or changes as we go on. And museums are at that spot of being able to informally educate children, adults, elderly. We're at a very good spot to be able to talk to everyone. And if you look at survey after survey, museums, whether you're talking about history or science or whatever subject it is, we are one of the, if not the most trusted sources of information that the public comes across. And so that's one of those things that, especially when we're talking about something like firearms, it is something that we don't have to be just completely in your face about the subject. We don't have to go after a certain political agenda. We just simply need to normalize the subject just like any other otherwise controversial subject could be seen as.
Sure, absolutely. Yeah, you couldn't have said it better. And you would know that certainly better than many of us in the museum world, having worked at the Cody Firearms Museum. You were there for how many years were you there?
I was at Cody Firearms Museum for about 6 years. I arrived in 2003. Museum was just over 20 years old at the time. And I was putting my history degree to good use, my history master's to good use as a computer programmer. And so,
yeah, perfectly good use.
I was like, you've got to pay the rent how you can pay the rent.
Yeah.
And so what I thought at the time was my dream job, it opened up in Cody, and I went in not expecting to get hired. My solid museum experience was working as a student intern on a weapons exhibit that was done at the Museum of the Rockies in Bozeman, Montana, on the campus of Montana State, where I was getting my master's. And so I get hired in Cody to, my main marching orders were to go and reinstall the Firearms Museum, and which, due to a number of different reasons, both my side, I think there were some issues and errors I made on my side. There were some issues I had with my board of advisors at the time. Some of the folks there, their idea of an improvement to the museum was painting and replacing the carpet, whereas I was wanting to really go to some much broader, let's knock the walls down and build back up again and really expand the subjects, expand the learning opportunities, knowing that half, if not two thirds of the people who walk into the Cody Firearms Museum are not gun people. Like, typically you'll see usually the husband, don't want to stereotype here, but it's usually the husband with the family members dragged along behind them, and they may or may not be interested in the story. Sure. But where the one person who's a firearms enthusiast would get really excited about the story, everybody else would kind of get overwhelmed by the sheer number of firearms that are in that collection, in that exhibit, especially with how stark the original design of the museum was. Great design, very visually stunning, yes. But it was overwhelming to the people who were the novice. It was overwhelming to the people who were not as insanely enthusiastic about firearms as some of the scholars who were involved. And so I was pushing forward some changes, and when it became pretty apparent that that wasn't going to happen at that time. And I think it's one of those things I cannot say enough good things about our good friend just recently stepped down as the curator, Ashley Hlubinski, and the work that she did, simply because I was able to see so much of what my plans and goals were. She was finally able to get that done. And I think it was just the right situation, board, staff, money, everything. And right. So I was really excited to see that happen over the last few years.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, she and well, now the curator, since Ashley's changed, yep, but Danny Michael, Danny, yeah, they both did a fantastic job getting that museum changed around. And like you said, it's an amazing collection. But, you know, I saw it both before and after the remodel that they got done. And I think you were with us the year at the firearms symposium when we determined that, you know, just a bunch of glass cases.
The Gunquarium.
Yeah. Gunquarium. Yeah. It's an aquarium filled with guns. And that's exactly what it was, which for a gun guy is awesome. And that's great for your collection at home. That is not great for a museum collection.
Yeah. And it's especially when you start to look at people who are like, they're like those of us who are just really enthusiastic about the subject and really wanting to know everything about everything. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of people out there, even a lot of gun owners, they don't have the time or the interest for that level of knowledge. And I think it says something to this point that when I first arrived there at different points, I loved getting a chance to tour people through the galleries. And on different opportunities, I had my mom, who has never had a place, in her life for firearms. She just basically knew which end was the end that you pointed at other people, and she knew which end not to point at other people. Right. And so depending on what your use was. And then you had my father-in-law, who was Montana born and bred, grew up with Winchester Model 70 in his shoulder, during his lifetime, probably killed more deer and elk out of season than any three people I know shot in season. He's passed away, so there's nothing that can be done there. Let's just say that the game warden knew him by name. But both of them, as I toured them through that collection on different occasions, we got done seeing the 2,000 firearms on exhibit upstairs, not counting the ones that were up on exhibit downstairs. And they both had the same comment to me. I never knew there were so many guns in the world. And me, that's not the takeaway you want to have. It's like even getting toured through by the guy who's in charge of the place, who's explaining the history and explaining the importance and all of just everything. They're completely overwhelmed by the sheer volume of hardware. Yeah. And there's better ways to go about doing it and better ways to show the importance of the firearms. I think what is in Cody now is awesome. I think that the Fraser Museum in Louisville, Kentucky, when it was first opened.
Yeah.
That was one of those things. I was privileged enough just due to where I was at that time. I was at the grand opening of that in Louisville. And that was an amazing presentation that showed history and it showed the firearms role in that history. And it wasn't trying to beat anything politically. It wasn't trying to club you over the head to get you to understand the point. It was, right. It just went right through that story. And here's this, and this is why this is all important. And it kind of goes back to one of those things I've started to really appreciate from my current boss is old stuff's not important. Important stuff's important. Important stuff is important because it has a story to it. And so along those lines, if you just got a wall or a gun aquarium full of hardware, what does it mean? Why am I seeing 12 versions of this and 6 versions of that? And there are a small number of us who will understand that. But unfortunately, the vast majority of people who see our exhibits won't appreciate it. We have to remember who our audience is.
Yep, absolutely. So this is a good transition because you're talking about your current boss. So let's move away from Cody and let's talk about the Marshals Museum. So in the grand scheme of things, the United States Marshals Museum is a relatively new museum.
It's so new, we aren't even open yet.
Yeah, imagine that. So so tell us how this museum came to be and what its goals are and what are your goals with it for both the interpretation, obviously, of the Marshals, and of course, talking marshals and firearms, which are, you know, certainly linked, most definitely.
Right. The Marshals Museum, right now, it's in Fort Smith, Arkansas. For anybody who's not familiar with the story of Charles Portis's novel, True Grit, or the films that have been made based off of that, the two films with John Wayne, the later Coen Brothers film, with Bridges and Jeff Bridges. The story of Fort Smith is really kind of where a lot of people think of when they think of the Marshals. They think of this 20-year period under what a lot of folks think of as the hanging judge.
Yeah, Judge Parker.
Yep, Isaac Parker. A lot of people kind of focus on that, and they think that the Marshals were created for this area, working in Indian Territory and Oklahoma Territory. And then after Parker died, they think that the Marshals went away. And it's like, well, no, the story's much greater than that. It started with George Washington. The Marshals are still doing their job today. It was the first act of the United States Senate in 1789 was to create the federal judiciary, all the district courts, and as part of that, the Office of United States Marshal. And when you have a territory here in the United States, the marshal is the law enforcement source for that. And so the marshal for the Western District of Arkansas, headquartered here in Fort Smith, that person in that seat was responsible for the enforcement of federal laws in the Indian Territory, as well as in Oklahoma Territory, farther to the west. And so in some of those areas would later get chopped up, and eventually Indian Territory would have their own marshals assigned. But that's really kind of what a lot of people think of romantically as like the high point of the marshals.
Right.
And so the reason why the Marshals Museum is here is partially because of that. It's partially here because over the history of the Marshals Service, 376 men and women have died in the line of duty serving the marshals. Of that, a third of those people, 122, died in what's now Oklahoma doing that job. And wow. most of that 122 were operating out of the court here in Fort Smith. And so this is sacred ground to the Marshal Service. I took a picture, the picture that you and I were talking about earlier. I took that from our atrium looking out across the Arkansas River into Oklahoma. And that's the same view that would have been here 150 years ago when deputies were taking a ferry across the river certain parts of the year, just like they do in the film, riding their horses across the Arkansas River. It was low enough at that time to do it. And so that's part of the reason why we're here. But really, our mission is to tell that entire 230-plus year story. We talk about the very first marshals in 1789. We talk about operations that are going on today. We talk about the civil rights era. We talk about, we also talk about the good. We have to talk about the bad related to civil rights. We talk about the enforcement of the Fugitive Slave Act during the first half of the 1800s. there's different controversial things that have happened over the course of the history of the Office of U.S. Marshal, and we talk about those. But so much of what we do, we want people to understand the role of the marshals and the role that, of them in American history. And we kind of semi-jokingly talk about how Marshall's history is American history, American history is Marshall's history. Anytime there's been a major event which took place in the United States, marshals have been involved. Whether you're talking about the Whiskey Rebellion, the Civil Rights Movement, 9/11. We're coming up next year on the 20th anniversary of 9/11. Some of the first people on the scene at Ground Zero were Deputy U.S. Marshals. Their office was three blocks away. And immediately following that, about a dozen airports on the Eastern Seaboard were taken over by the Marshals Service. Because remember, TSA had not been created yet. Their Department of Homeland Security had not been created yet. Who was supposed to take over all these different jobs? It wasn't the FBI. It wasn't their mission. It wasn't ATF. It wasn't their mission. The Marshals have been described as the other duties agency for many years, simply because if something comes up that needs to be done at the federal level, the Marshals are usually who gets those orders. And so there's a lot of different things that have gone on over America's history, whether it's chasing draft dodgers during World War I, World War II, or Vietnam, whether it is going after enemy aliens during any of those time frames. If you are, I mean, just enforcing the Alien and Sedition Acts during the 1800s. I mean, it's crazy the amount of jobs these men and women have had. And yeah. So we get to tell that story, and it's not an easy one to tell. We do like to focus on the use of the word story. Simply kind of back to that comment of old stuff's not important, important stuff is important.
Sure.
We are identifying the stories that help people understand the marshals, and we have objects to help support those. And so, yes, we're a gun, and we've got guns and badges in our collection. But guns and badges don't tell the entire story. We've got a lot of paper. One of my favorite things in the collection is an original copy of the restraining order that was in the breast pocket of one of the deputies escorting three little girls up onto the steps of McDonough 19 in New Orleans in 1962.
No kidding.
Yeah, I mean, it's just, you look at stuff like that. I've got... we've got materials that were carried on Ruby Ridge. We've got materials that were involved with the deaths of a number of different deputies. And that's really kind of one of the only limits that we have on what we are willing to put out on exhibit. Mm-hmm. We have a number of weapons that were used in the killing of different deputies. For example, if you look up Gordon Call, Gordon Call was the... really considered by many people to be one of the early leaders of what's now kind of thought of as the sovereign citizen or anti-tax movement. I know sovereign citizens and anti-tax people, it's a big Venn diagram with some crossover. Not all sovereign citizens agree with each other. Not all anti-tax right. people agree with each other. He was posse comitatus. He was an early leader in the Christian Identity Church movement. It's a really not a nice guy. He was racist. He wanted to fight the government, and but he was a decorated bomber gunner during World War II. Comes back home, gets into trouble with the government, starts listening to some different people about taxes, and starts falling in with folks who believe that he shouldn't have to pay taxes. Goes to prison in Texas. Comes out of prison, is part of that release order. He cannot leave Texas. What does he do? He goes back home to North Dakota. So they find that out. He's breaking his probation. The marshal in North Dakota finds out that, oh, this guy is up here. He's broken his probation. And this is the marshal in North Dakota at the time, had been a former deputy. He had been at Old Miss the night of the riots when they were integrating that university. Uh-huh. But he decides, he and three deputies and a couple of local law enforcement are gonna go and arrest Gordon Call. Gordon and his wife, his son, Yori Call, and another friend, they were leaving a meeting where he was telling people how they could not pay taxes. And so they set up a roadblock, they stop him. Yori Call and Gordon Call get out of their vehicles, and they both are carrying the anti-government weapon of choice during the 80s, the Ruger Mini 14. And so they get up out of their vehicles and they have a little standoff, and Yori and Gordon open fire on the deputy, on one of the deputies, the U.S. Marshal, and just all hell breaks loose. Mm. By the time everything is said and done, Gordon Call had gone up, and by the witnesses' accounts during different investigations into this and during Yor Vander's court case, Yori was injured at the scene, was apprehended, and is now still in prison. His father, Gordon, is believed to have gone up and executed both the United States Marshal and the deputy. And we have the gun that was in the hands of Yor Vander. We have the gun that was in the hands of Gordon Call. Those guns will never be on exhibit.
Sure.
We will tell the story of what happened, as well as the later capture. Well, they didn't capture Gordon Call. He went on the run for about 4 months. He was found in Arkansas, surrounded. There was a standoff. Gordon Call ended up getting fatally shot, but they didn't realize that he had been fatally shot. There was a fire in the building that where Gordon Call was hiding, under the attempt to smoke him out. The building set on fire, ended up going on fire. And there's ridiculous conspiracy theories online about all of this event. But so we have the firearm that he carried with him that day. But that's kind of what we've determined here, is that we're going to have firearms of bad guys when we get a hold of them. Mm-hmm. But if it's a firearm that was used in the killing of a deputy or a U.S. Marshal, those are not going to be put on exhibit.
Sure. Yeah, it makes perfect sense. Those are instances where the items are not as important as the story.
Right.
They are forever linked. But you don't need to put that gun on display, and God knows what kind of individual might make some kind of weird pilgrimage.
And that right there, you just kind of hit one of the things that we're looking at as a reason why we want to be careful what we have. There are a number of folks, whether you're talking about Gordon Call or if you're talking about Ruby Ridge, we don't want to become an attractant point for people who want to come and worship at the altar of Gordon Call or anybody else involved with that movement. And sure. So we have materials related to those events. We have the confession Gordon Call made on a big piece of, it's either an old paper shopping bag or a piece of butcher paper. We've got his confession that he made. We have a couple of other things related to that situation or the situation in Idaho at Ruby Ridge or some other events through time. But we're going to make it about the event. We're going to make it about the story of what happened there and look at the reasons why. And in most of those cases, we'll be able to explain, this is why the marshals were there. And right. This is why this is like everything went sideways. We will not hide the fact that when, for example, Ruby Ridge, things completely went sideways from what was supposed to happen there. And it just like the whole thing just steamrolled downhill. And we'll explain why the marshals were there. And that's in all of the different cases we have. There's a reason that the marshals show up someplace. They don't just decide, we're going to go do this. Mm-hmm. And so that's part of the story we're telling.
Gotcha. So let's talk about a marshal whose firearm that you guys have that you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I'm pretty darn sure is going to go on display because he was an amazing individual, is Bass Reeves.
Bass Reeves. We have the largest collection of Bass Reeves materials that we know of anywhere in public. We have on hand here in the building his Spencer carbine. We have his model 1892. We've got two Colt single action armies and the Colt 1902 he's believed to have carried while he was working as a Muskogee police officer.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And it's pretty cute. I've always really have an attraction for the 1902. I love those little things. But we also have two other guns right now. that do belong, that were Bass Reeves. Those are currently on loan, and anybody in the public can go see those. If they go through Springfield, Missouri, they're on loan at the National Rifle Association's Sporting Arms Museum that's there at the Bass Pro Shops. That's another Colt single action and his Winchester 73 that he had.
Yep. Yeah, that's how I was exposed to Bass's guns, because when I worked at the NRA museums, I found myself out at the museum in Springfield on a handful of occasions. And there's an exhibit case there that's dedicated to law enforcement. And so it's got a variety of different pieces and police guns and things of that nature. And one of the focal pieces are Bass's guns in there. And of course, it mentions on the exhibit label, you know, they're on loan from the Marshall's Museum, you know, forthcoming in Fort Smith. And so, yeah, that's Bass was such an interesting individual and had such a really a remarkable life. He born into slavery, if I'm correct, right?
Yeah, he was actually born across the Arkansas River up here in Crawford County outside of Van Buren, Arkansas. Okay. His owner had a farm that was up in that area, and Bass was born in the 1830s. His owner during the late 1830s, early 1840s, moved down to Texas, the other side of the Red River from Oklahoma, and set up a plantation there. During the Civil War period, the story goes, and again, a lot of this stuff is stories simply because it's become folklore. It's become just passing it down, and this is what we believe happened. We've not been able to find documentation on a lot of this. Mm-hmm. But according to the stories, Bass was, his owner's son became an officer in a volunteer cavalry regiment that was formed in Texas in that particular county. And so Bass went along as the hand servant or the body man or however you want to call it he was a slave. He had no choice in that matter. Went along as the servant to his owner's son. And at some point, the way the story goes, it might have been any point along the line, we believe it occurred either in what's now Oklahoma or what's now Arkansas. There were another number of opportunities where this could have happened. Bass and his owner's son get into a card game. Bass starts to win, and the owner's son says, "You know what, Bass, you win this hand. I'll give you your freedom." And Bass ends up winning the hand. The owner's son says, "Oh, you didn't believe that, did you? I'm not going to give you your freedom." At which point Bass stands up, words are thrown back and forth. And then Bass reaches back, cold cocks the guy, knocks him out, grabs his pocket watch and runs off to Indian territory where he knows that he's going to be able to be safe. Right. And as part of that, what he ends up doing is like, we've got the watch. A number of these materials ended up falling down through some family. But we've got the watch. Bass runs off to Indian territory, spends time there. The Civil War is over. Bass goes down, gets the woman who's going to be his wife. They have a couple kids in Texas. They move up to the Fort Smith area and actually move back up to Crawford County by Van Buren. Bass starts up a small farm, and as close as we can tell, he spends a little bit of time working as a posse for one of the deputies here in town. We don't know who it was, but he goes from being a posse member to being a deputy, and as far as we can tell, becomes either the second or third black man to be a deputy here in this court. Wow. And so there's at least one, possibly two other black men who were deputies here, but they were not the last. There were, as far as we can tell, at least 12 or 13 other men who served as deputies here out of this court. He ends up going on to become a deputy for most of 30 years. I say most of because it was kind of off and on. It was about 10 years here in Fort Smith. That an end was put to that tenure when he, as far as we can tell, by accident, killed his camp cook in a negligent discharge of the rifle that he was carrying at the time. His camp cook is killed. Everybody realizes it was a mistake. About a year later, someone brings up a charge against him for murder in that case. And so he ends up, has to sell his farm, has to move into a rental in the north end of Fort Smith, has to defend himself in court for that murder. But during that entire time, from when the charges are filed, he's unable to work as a deputy.
Okay.
So that court case comes down. He's found innocent of those charges. He then realizes he can't work here in town anymore, or for one reason or another. He goes down and starts working out of the court in Paris, Texas, and really kind of move in the court in Paris, Texas, Eastern District of Texas. They had a lot of jurisdiction over the southern end of Indian Territory, so that's Choctaw Nation. He works a lot in the Choctaw Nation, which is where he was rumored to have been hiding out during the Civil War. And so he's working in the Choctaw Nation area, does that for a number of years. And then in the later 1890s, the city of Muskogee receives the office for the Northern District of Indian Territory. By this time, the court had realized that the court's use in Fort Smith was kind of done. A lot of the different tribal members across Indian Territory were not happy with how that court was being operated and how it was affecting people in the Indian Territory. So Indian Territory was broken up into three districts, each of them given their own federal court, a U.S. Marshal, and then deputies underneath that U.S. Marshal. And Bass became one of the deputies in Muskogee. And he worked in that court until Oklahoma statehood, 1907. He works as a police officer for the city of Muskogee for a couple of years until 1909. And then he starts to get ill. And from what we understand, it was kidney disease, what a lot of people refer to at the time, Bright's disease. Kidney ailment ends up finally ending his life in 1910.
Wow. That's an amazing story. I mean, he had an amazing life. You figure, you know, born as a piece of property.
Yeah.
Let's make no bones about that. Born as someone's property and goes on to work for one of, you know, the preeminent law enforcement agencies in the United States. I mean, that's,
yes,
that is a hell of a life trajectory.
Yeah. I mean, you can sit there and you look at all the stuff that he did and how here we are 110 years after his death talking about him. And granted, due to our country being what our country is, for most of the 20th century, no one knew his name outside of a small circle of people in the Muskogee, Oklahoma area. Maybe people who were really, really into history of the marshals in this region. Mm-hmm. But if you go someplace like newspapers.com, between his death and about 1960, you're not going to see the name Bass Reeves show up in the newspaper hardly at all, unless it's some retrospective about old timers remember Bass Reeves. And it's just that kind of a thing will show up in the newspaper.
Right.
But really, it's like we're fortunate that work by folks like Art Burton, a historian who literally wrote the book on Bass Reeves. I'll sing the praises of Art Burton all day just because he brought that story and many other stories to light. Whether it's Black Gun Silver Star, which is the biography of Bass Reeves, or Black, Red, and Deadly, an earlier book that he wrote about people of color in the American West, especially in law enforcement. I have a couple of issues though with Art's work, and one of those is the creation of the Lone Ranger myth that permeates Facebook and social media and yep. Oh, such places like the History Channel and other things. Bass Reeves was not the Lone Ranger. The guys who created the Lone Ranger had no idea who Bass Reeves was.
Yeah.
And it's just why they would have created this guy. They were just, with my reading of books by people like Zane Grey, with a lot of other books that have been written over time, I think their work to create the Lone Ranger was created just more out of searching for a dollar to get advertising money for their radio station than anything else. And I would love to be able to say, and if somebody finds something that shows me where they found Bass Reeves and that was the origin story, I would shout that to high heaven and say, hey, I was wrong. And there's a couple of other people in American history, especially regarding where the Marshals are concerned, who at some point in the future, we're going to be coming out more, more talking about some of these people. I know a certain university over in Oklahoma that's not going to be happy with me when some of these stories come out, but just because I know too many things about their mascot. But yeah, it's the one of those things though was the Lone Ranger aspect, and there's a couple of other stories that Mr. Burton likes to take a little bit more favor with a really good story and a little bit less favor with the documented facts.
Sure.
But and for the most part, he gets it right.
Right. And unfortunately, that's it's not an uncommon thing, even among, you know, people who are supposed to be, you know, lauded historians and stuff. I mean, yeah. you mentioned the History Channel, and, you know, I mean, it's not much of a History Channel anymore, but, you know, but there was certainly a time where documentaries on the History Channel were very well respected, and they had some very well respected individuals on there.
And then they also had people like me.
It was,
I actually was, if you go online, sometimes you can find it online. There's they did a series called Wild West Tech.
Yeah. With the Carradine brothers.
With the Carradine brothers. There was an episode they did about six shooter technology. I was interviewed for that episode.
Were you really?
I was. That was a much younger David Kennedy on that video.
Well, I'll have to figure out what date it aired, and then we can mark that as the exact date that the History Channel died, because they started letting people like Dave Kennedy come on the show.
I would fully agree with that.
Yeah, no, you paved the way for Pawn Stars, right?
Oh, please.
And Ancient Aliens.
Fortunately, I've not been on either of those. I have friends who have been on Pawn Stars.
Oh,
but,
goodness.
But yeah. History Channel's a special thing.
Special is one word for it. It's not the word I'd use, but it's the most polite word we can use here. So do you have a favorite museum collection that you've been in or that you've worked with over the years?
Cody.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't even need to pause that. it's this, I've had, and it's with the benefit of my job and like, especially there or just the people I've known in the field, I can, if I'm visiting someplace, yeah, I'm going to go check out their stuff. I've been in the back halls of the NRA. I've been in the bottom of a number of museums across the country that have some amazing gun collections, and really, and I really get a kick out of going to regular, just kind of just general history museums, because even though you might run into a place that has no firearms on display, there's going to be a gun in the collection someplace.
Yep.
And there were, especially some of the art museums, some amazing stuff. Art Institute of Chicago, their collection of Ray Welgus guns, for anybody who doesn't know. So Ray Welgus was a guy who lived in Chicago, was a prototyper for a couple of manufacturing companies. This is back in the 40s, 50s, 60s, when as a prototyper, he would either be working with clay or wood or metal and creating, based off a design drawing, a refrigerator or a stand mixer, or just whatever a company was making, they would pay the company that he worked at, we need it to match this picture. And okay. So he would do that stuff. So he just had naturally those skills. He retires, he's looking for meaning. He'd never been a gun guy, had never done engraving. He sees a book, he figured, I'm gonna try this. So he starts buying up cheap guns, and he starts engraving them and turning them into these masterworks, especially because I'm talking about like my favorite collection. I'm completely going off on a tangent. But it's one of the issues that he had with American firearms engraving. It's one of the issues I've had for a number of years, is American firearms engraving of all of the different decorative arts. Everything else got to the 1880s and 90s and then continued on through Art Deco and Art Nouveau and like hitting Bauhaus on the way and just going into everything else. American firearms engraving stopped.
Yeah.
At, like the Ulrich brothers and what was going on at Colt and Winchester. And so today, if you are a firearms engraver, if you can't do Ulrich, you don't need to be in the field because you're not going to be able to pay your rent.
Right.
So what he was doing is he was doing a lot of other different art movements in his engraving. And okay. So he's got some amazing pieces, a good chunk. And this is one of those proud moments of mine from my time in Cody, is the relationship I built with him in Tucson, Arizona, where he was living in his retirement. We were able to get the guns that he had when he was in Tucson. And those are all on exhibit. They arrived in Cody after I left. They're all on exhibit there in the, not all of them, but most of them are on exhibit in the embellished arms gallery that's there in Cody.
Yeah.
He had a huge chunk of them though, also, that went to the Art Institute of Chicago.
Okay.
And so some of them, there's usually two or three of them on exhibit. Most of them are in storage. But just some amazing pieces that you'll see. So like these are squirreled away at the Art Institute and
right.
you'll see similar things all over the country. But just every time I go around, like I mentioned at the beginning of this, my quick answer for my favorite collection being Cody, anytime I've ever been to any museum or anybody's personal private collection, and I've run into people who are just amazingly proud of this piece that they have, this whatever. And I'm like, oh, that's cute. and you just see them just deflate.
Yeah.
Because like, we had four of those in Cody. Or, I saw this and this. This is the one that he did when he was practicing to make that one.
Right. And, you get jaded almost, you know.
Yeah. And so I was spoiled, so badly spoiled for seeing anything else. But one of the things that it also did for me is I don't have to be excited by everything that I see. And I have learned so many more times what to look for in, like, what's wrong. And as soon as somebody starts telling me a really cool story, I know well, they said this, and this, and you know this, and you know it right here. That this is all true. And I'm like, no, you don't. and I feel so bad. And you feel horrible. I remember my first time to Vegas for the Antique Arms Show. I went out to go to the SHOT Show. And this was at that time, that particular, every so often, the Antique Arms Show in Vegas is the same week as the SHOT Show.
Yep.
So one day I took off from the SHOT Show, went over to the Antique Arms Show, which was it was at the Mandalay Bay. It's like this huge death march all the way out through the convention center end of the Mandalay. And I take a look, and because I worked at Cody, we had the Winchester Marlin and L.C. Smith records there.
Right.
They've expanded it into a couple of other companies.
Savage and H. Fox.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And that was, again, I was so happy to be able to say, I started working with Savage years ago. It's like, hey, you guys, whenever you don't want to deal with your records.
Right.
So.
They got a home for them.
Yeah. So they ended up. Every time that you go to a gun show as that guy, people's like, hey, can you call this in? And sure. It's like whoever would be in the office that day. And so I'd call in, and this one guy had three 1892s in a rack behind his table. And he said, yeah, this is this, and this is that, and this is that. And I'm sitting there as I'm dialing, looking down at the guns going, okay, that's wrong, and that's wrong. And so I called up, and I can't remember who it was, Connie or John Hawkins, who used to work there. They are answering the phone and they start walking through what's on the guns. And I'm just kind of like, yeah, that's wrong. And that's wrong. And that's wrong. And I tell the guy that, and he's just like heartbroken. And I didn't even want to ask how much money he had just thrown into those three guns.
Yeah.
And this is a guy who had been doing this. And this is one of the things that really kind of started to scare me, as the new guy in Cody, was how many people were doing this business who didn't know what they were doing.
Yeah.
And sure. You'll still see that today, the people who want to buy a story where they look at a gun and like they've got visions of dollar signs dancing in their heads.
Right.
And they don't recognize, okay, no, that finish does not match that finish, or this wood is too proud, or this doesn't do that. And it's not hard. You just have to look and be able to step back from what you're dealing with.
And it's hard sometimes, you know, because sometimes the story just is so enticing and so enchanting, and you know, you want it to be so and so's gun. You know, I mean, I've heard a story. You know, that there are enough slivers of Christ's cross to have built the Ark. You know. Yeah. And it's the same way with guns, you know. George Washington, you know, must have owned like 30,000 guns, and you know.
Or stuff like that. Back to my days in Wyoming, got a phone call one day. This wonderful older woman calls up, and she's telling me about how her husband just passed away, and he had a gun, and she wanted to find out what she might be able to do with it, and we might be interested in it because it was a gun that her late husband's uncle received from Buffalo Bill Cody.
Of course he did.
And so I'm thinking, okay, tell me some stuff about the gun. What are the markings on it? So we end up nailing, and that's the great thing about so many companies is they kept wonderful records.
Yeah.
And people have been able to publish those records, at least general terms, online. So we know at least years of manufacture. At that point, anytime I mention years of manufacture, I have to say, watch out for Winchester lever actions around 1895 to 1903. It's a mess. Right. And don't believe the George Mattis numbers when it comes to those guns.
Yeah.
His numbers were not correct for most of those guns. That said, for Colt, I figured out pretty quickly, I can't remember now which type of double action, but it was a double action Colt revolver of some sort. And the serial number says that gun was made in 1926.
That's a problem.
And so I explained to her, ma'am, I'm sorry, but this gun could not have been given to your late husband's uncle by Bill Cody, because, well, he died in 1917. The gun was manufactured in 1926, at which point there was silence on the other end of the phone, and a long breath. Sir, I will have you know, and she starts into this diatribe about the how I'm impugning the honor of her husband. He was the most honorable person who ever lived. He was just running me ragged because I had just said her husband was a horrible, no good, dirty liar, essentially. And I had to get her to understand, no, ma'am, your husband's uncle was
right
telling stories.
Yeah.
I'm not saying anything at all. I'm not casting aspersions on your husband. I'm casting aspersions on his uncle, because right, the story that he gave to your husband could be telling the best of the stories he knows. The story that was told to him was not true.
Right.
And so it's just busting the bubble sometimes has to happen, but those stories are going to be out there, and you know that she's going to tell, like, whatever happened, she could have just gone on and told this story to somebody,
mm-hmm,
and they could have thought, oh, this is a Buffalo Bill gun, and then found out later on it wasn't.
Right.
It's like occasionally there was a guy in the 90s, no, the 90s or 2000s down in Tennessee who was taking old Belgian and English hammer shotguns, cutting the barrel short, slapping a brass plaque in the shape of a shield on the side of the shoulder of the stock, punching in WF and Co. number 6.
Yeah, Wells Fargo. And,
yeah, and he was selling those all over the place with the story that he's had this for a long time. And I know this because I've talked to at least three people who bought from the guy. I've got this gun. I'm just really hurt for cash. I've got to sell this gun. I'll take $500 for it. And you know right. that the guy maybe put 50 or 100 bucks into it before he cut off the barrel and put the sheet brass on there. Sure. And so he goes off and does his thing. About 3 years ago, I got a phone call from someone fit the exact same description. Apparently, he decided to move from Wells Fargo guns to U.S. Marshals guns.
Oh, geez.
So I know at least one out there. But yeah, and every time I talk to any of these folks, they got these guns out of Tennessee.
How about that? Well, that's a good warning for people. And I'm always leery of, particularly Wells Fargo stuff, because we've seen
oh, yeah.
so many issues with that come up. Yeah, it's just been ridiculous. But so as we wrap up here, I have the most important and heavy and hard hitting question that I'm going to ask you of the entire process here. What arms designer, past or present, would you want to meet and why?
Oh, let's see. Oh, there's probably one or two I'd like to like meet and punch. No.
I want to hear who those are.
No, there's really, honestly, I mean, like the one to punch would be, what's his name at Winchester who took the credit for the M1 carbine. What's his name?
I'm not sure off the top of my head.
Because he actually ended up taking the nickname Carbine.
Oh, Carbine Williams.
Carbine Williams, yeah.
Yeah.
Just because he was just such a dirtbag. he ended up totally writing on the story of like how he made the gun, and when it was like five other people that made the gun. And yeah, but really, just like you sit there and you look at it, and you get all of the second and third guys who work at all of the different companies. It's like we all know Sam Colt, but right. then he had, what was it? The model 1855 was the,
Root.
Elisha Root. Yeah. Elihu Root was one of those guys. I'm like, okay, dude, you came in and you did this and so many other things and you didn't get hardly anything for it.
Right.
It just like people like him and now like I'm blanking on some of their names. The guy who did the Allen conversion to Springfield Armory everybody else is making these crazy. And again, this is one of the great things I was spoiled by at Cody was they had pretty much one of everything in the old Winchester study collection
right.
of the different guns that were manufactured as test samples for the government to replace the rifle musket.
Yeah.
And like all these breech loaders, all the repeaters, different actions and everything. And they're all $15, $20, $30, $35 in post-Civil War terms. And then you've got Alan coming out and going, well, I can just like mill this out here and put, there we go. That's $2. And
right.
So, yeah. So, I mean, it's just like I want to buy that guy a beer because that gun that he designed ended up, until the AR-15 platform, the M16, passed it, the Trapdoor Springfield was in use by the American military longer than any other firearm that we'd had in the arsenal. It was in use up through, it was in use by National Guard troops during World War I.
That's amazing.
Yeah. And so, I mean, it's like there's those stories like that. And it's, for me, most, and we've seen this in history and in most of the stories that get told about everybody, all the really famous gun designers were drama queens and horrible to work with. The relationship that the Brownings, well, especially John Browning's brother, didn't make anything easier. But like Browning was a prima donna. Colt was a prima donna. All of these guys, they were shysters at best in a lot of these cases. And then you look at the companies themselves and nobody really pays attention that like all of these companies, there were so many good ideas of firearms that were created that Winchester and Colt and Marlin and Savage and Remington went out and they would either buy up all of the patents and then not put them into production, or they would sue the companies into poverty.
Right.
Just so they couldn't make the whatever. And then, right. okay, out of receivership, we're going to go ahead and buy those patents. And yeah. I mean, it's just like, that's nothing new. today to what a lot of companies do.
Yeah, it's rampant in all sorts of industries.
Yeah. Yep. I mean, like, to me, it's always the second and third tier guys who made the small changes that made stuff work. The right. stuff that the names, like, everybody knows Colt and Winchester and Remington, and we know Sharps and we know Spencer and we know a lot of those names like that. But it's those guys who were that next step down in the chain who right. are making these changes and making the designs, like the big designs, making them more effective.
Gotcha. Yeah, that's great. That's a great answer. That's, you know, I love that you've got people you want to punch on the list, and unsung people that you want to buy a beer. That's perfect.
Yeah. Let me see. The one named guy I would think of would be Evans, because I mean, and so many people don't realize that the Evans repeating rifle mm-hmm. ever existed. I'm like, that was your first AR.
Yeah. Yeah, the Evans is a really cool
design. More than 20 rounds of legitimate rifle ammunition.
Yeah.
That you can fire. That was, yeah.
It's a game changer. Game changer.
And then Winchester buys out the patent, and then nobody ever sees it again.
Yep. Imagine that. Awesome. Well, Dave, I really appreciate you spending some time chatting with us. Again, this is Dave Kennedy at the United States Marshals Museum. You can find more information on the Marshals Museum at usmmuseum.org. And there will also be a link to it in the show notes as well. Dave, thank you so much. I really appreciate your time.
Thank you very much for having me. It's just been a blast getting a chance to chat about this stuff. And as you can tell, I don't enjoy it at all.
No. Well, you know, you're supposed to be miserable at work, right, Dave?
Yeah.
Awesome. Thanks again, Dave. Have a good day.
Thank you very much.
All right, bye-bye. Thanks for tuning into this episode of the High Caliber History Podcast. I hope you enjoyed it. And if you did, please consider leaving a review and a comment. Stay tuned. There's more episodes just like this coming up next week. We'll see you soon.